Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Complicated Choice, Making Space for Grief and Healing in the Pro-Choice Movement, by Katie Zay, foreword by Alexis McGill Johnson, narrated by Victoria Browning. Foreword. COVID-19 taught all of us what isolation can do. It destabilizes our communities and tests our spirits. People who tried to access abortion during the early days of the pandemic felt this isolation acutely. As governors used the crisis as an excuse to ban abortion, some patients drove 16 hours from Texas to California and Colorado just to access medication abortion. I think about how they must have felt on those long, lonely drives, isolated from loved ones by the virus, isolated from their trusted providers by politicians, terrified and utterly alone. That wasn't by accident. To borrow from Adam Serwer, the cruelty is the point. For decades, opponents of abortion have created barriers designed to alienate patients. Stigma, too, is meant to isolate us, and no medical procedure is more stigmatized than abortion. The truth is, abortion is common. Nearly one in four women will access it in her lifetime. But that's not the story we've been told. Because stigma is one of the most powerful tools of oppression, it operates invisibly. It creates its own pathway into our minds and becomes difficult to overcome. It's the foundation of the narratives we've consumed our whole lives, so it provides a ready justification for laws that limit our freedoms. And because stigma is so pervasive, it's not just perpetuated by our opponents. When we shy away from the more complicated and nuanced side of abortion stories, intentionally or not, we isolate one another. Even our most vocal supporters have internalized false narratives about abortion, race, gender, and class. I certainly have. To unlearn these stereotypes, accumulated over a lifetime of exposure, takes real work. For as long as I've been a part of the movement for reproductive rights, I've also been exploring questions about bias. I can't untangle the two. The same decade I first volunteered for Planned Parenthood, I was also leading the Perception Institute, a consortium of researchers, advocates, and strategists. We translated mind science research into solutions that reduce bias and discrimination. I've spent the better part of my career exploring how our brains process challenging conversations and experiences. Here's what I've learned. Our brains are amazing, but they're lazy. They slip into strong archetypes that reinforce stigma without us even realizing it's happening. But our brains also love stories. They're hardwired to use narratives to make meaning. We can use what we know about the mind sciences to our advantage. When we share abortion stories, we're actually building new, strong archetypes against stigma. Through the 17 stories in this book, Katie Zay is giving us the tools to build a new practice. To, as she says, develop our individual and collective capacity to offer compassion to one another. Sharing a story you've been told to hide is a radical act of defiance. And choosing to witness that story, without judgment or prejudice, is a radical act of grace. In the space between the telling and the hearing, the spirit is at work. As a movement for reproductive freedom, we need to create the conditions for these radical exchanges. We need to create a space where people can be vulnerable, where they will be seen and accepted for who they truly are. The 17 storytellers in this collection have trusted Katie with their truth, and in turn, she's modeling how we can build a movement for reproductive freedom with trust as its cornerstone. Where there is room for every story in all its fullness, where there is room for joy and ambivalence, for grief and its half-lives, for innocence and experience, for hardship and privilege. Where there is room for everyone who has had an abortion, women, men, trans, and non-binary people. Where you are not just welcome, you belong. As the nation's leading provider of sexual and reproductive health care, Planned Parenthood has a role to play here. In our hearts and in our movements, we need to make room for all kinds of complicated, beautiful stories. We need to show people it's okay to complicate the narrative. When you share your imperfect abortion story, You don't hurt our cause, you actually strengthen it. To wrestle with stories that make us uncomfortable or bump up against our deeply ingrained stigmas, we need to be braver. We cannot be afraid, even when our fear is coming from a very logical place. As abortion advocates, we know how our words can be twisted. We're so scared to get things wrong because millions of people have trusted us to get it right. Their ability to access healthcare depends on it. But life doesn't always make narrative sense. It's complicated. So are our stories. My own faith story is complicated. Maybe yours is too. For me, there was no moment on the road to Damascus. My relationship with God didn't come easy. Like many, I rebelled against my upbringing in a characteristically cliché way. I don't do organized religion. I'm more of a spiritual person. My mom, faith warrior that she is, would shout after me, "Remember Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11? For I know the plans I have for you, plans to prosper you and not harm you, plans to give you hope and a future." I envied my mom's surety in that plan during many dark times in my life, which in itself misses the point. Faith emerges most clearly in dark times. It may seem ironic, but that insight is what helped me find a way into a pew to build my practice and reconcile the intangible. God speaks when we sit still and listen. That's something Reverend Katie Zay does so brilliantly. She listens, then brings stories to life in all their glorious, messy complexities. Her voice is as vibrant here as it is in our movement. Unapologetic, brimming with love, and guided by faith. She has a singular talent for making us think twice about scripture we thought we knew by heart, only to find something new and transformative. She uses the Bible to hold up a mirror to the fight for gender justice today, both in this book and in Women Rise Up, Sacred Stories of Resistance for Today's Revolution. However this book found its way to you, I hope you listen to it with the same spirit in which Katie wrote. Bring an open heart. Give these stories permission to change you. When strong feelings surface, honor them and name them. Remember that testimonies of grief and ambivalence don't harm our fight for freedom. They are freedom in action. Have faith in that power. Faith and fear cannot coexist. We always have a choice. In Mark chapter 5, verses 25 through 34, the hemorrhaging woman's faith overcame her fear. She cast off the shroud of stigma and spoke her truth. Katie Zay asks us to consider this moment as not just healing for her, but perhaps for everyone who witnessed her. Toni Morrison said, "The function of freedom is to free someone else." Sharing your story doesn't just free you. It gives others the tools to imagine freedom. So step out of your fear. Tell the story on your heart, the one only you can tell. Let's get free. Alexis McGill Johnson, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Preface. On a steamy June morning in 2007, I made the one-mile drive from my apartment to the abortion clinic where I'd scheduled my appointment. As I turned off the main road and onto the side street where the facility was located, I felt a prickling surge of adrenaline course through my body like an alarm system that had been triggered. Just outside the clinic entrance, a group of protesters, all of them gray-headed and white-presenting, took up most of the length of the sidewalk. One was an older man who wore a clerical collar and held up a Bible in his right hand. They were holding signs bearing gruesome, bloody images and condemning words in bold block lettering I did my best to ignore. Approaching the parking lot, I had no choice but to bring my car to a near stop as I pulled up into the steep driveway. That momentary pause in my speed was their opportunity, one they had practiced and perfected. Two of the protesters approached my car, thrusting their hands toward the driver's side window, only a thin pane of glass separating us. They held pamphlets too small for me to read, but I didn't need to see them to know exactly what they said. "You don't have to kill your baby." I kept my focus on the road, averted my eyes from theirs, and parked as far away from the sidewalk as possible. I'd arrived at the clinic with time to spare. I'm habitually early, especially when nervous. My appointment wasn't for a few more minutes, and I wanted the chance to collect myself. I didn't want the people on the sidewalk to see just how shaken I felt. I dabbed at the beads of sweat on my forehead and estimated how long I thought the walk to the clinic entrance would take me. Okay, I thought to myself. This will take less than 10 seconds. I can do anything for 10 seconds. Then I will be inside, and I won't have to see them again until I leave. I closed my eyes, took a deep breath, and prayed for peace. Then I stepped out of my car. With my gaze toward the ground, I hurried across the pavement to the locked clinic door and buzzed the front desk to let them know I was there. After giving them my name, I waited a few seconds, though it felt like minutes, before being let in. That was when I realized that the group of protesters had begun screaming at me from the sidewalk. Their vicious shouts carried as I made my way inside. God doesn't want you to kill your baby. You'll regret your abortion. You don't have to do this. We can help you. Not that it mattered, but what the protesters didn't know was that I was not at the clinic to get an abortion that day. I was there to help care for the people who were. While I am not among the 1 in 4 U.S. women who has needed an abortion in her lifetime, I recognize that I could be. I've used emergency contraception. I've had late periods. I've feared that my birth control method had failed. I've prayed for a pregnancy test to be negative. And as I've waited, I've had racing thoughts about what I would do if that pink line appeared. I always imagined that I would become a parent one day, but not when I was a full-time student living with roommates, or while I was working an entry-level job that barely covered my monthly rent and student loan payments, or in the midst of leaving an unstable relationship with an emotionally absent and unemployed partner. To my great relief, the only time that a pink line appeared on a test was when I hoped and prayed it would. When I walked into the clinic that day, I had thought about what I would encounter inside, but I had not prepared for what it would feel like to be on the outside as a target of the protesters' rage and shame tactics. I felt all alone, vulnerable, and completely exposed. And yet what I experienced was only a small fraction of the relentless and cruel harassment, shame, and stigma that people face every day as they try to access critical reproductive health care. That experience was jarring, not only because I had been yelled at, but also because I'd been mistaken for an abortion patient. Part of me wanted to scream back, "But I'm not here to have an abortion. I'm not even pregnant." The fact that I cared about what these people thought of me and my reason for being there gave me pause. Until that moment, I might have felt firm in my staunchly pro-choice convictions, but being perceived as someone in need of an abortion was deeply unsettling, and I needed to unpack exactly why. In retrospect, I can see clearly that despite my beliefs that abortion should be legal and accessible, I also held a lot of judgmental views and internalized stigma about who actually gets them. In that way, I wasn't all that different from the protesters. Sure, I supported abortion in the abstract sense as a political and moral issue, but I also bought into false narratives about the people who decide to end their pregnancies. And they were not people like me. I had fallen into the trap of a common narrative shaped by patriarchy and white supremacy, that while abortion should be available for others, it was not for people like me. I was convinced that I would never have one myself because I was white and middle class and had access to education. Thanks to a whole host of unearned privileges, including affordable health care, economic resources, and a bit of good luck, I have not been in the position of making a difficult decision about a pregnancy, but I easily could have been. Had I been confronted with an unplanned pregnancy, I would have had every tool and resource available to make the best decision at the time. Tragically, that is not true for everyone, not even close. Racism, sexism, classism, ableism, xenophobia, and all other forms of oppression perpetuate systems of reproductive injustice that not only deny marginalized people access to abortion care, but also deny their basic human dignity and freedom. The summer I spent volunteering in an abortion clinic was transformative for me. Since that morning when I first entered the clinic doors, I have had the enormous honor of walking alongside many people through their reproductive journeys. While I never expected to receive a call to ministry inside that clinic, I am grateful each day that I did. On my first day of volunteering, I was set up to shadow the clinic staff as they guided patients through the entire abortion process, from intake to being discharged. I was sitting in a small office with the first patient who had agreed to let me observe her appointment. The staff member had to leave the room for a moment to get a form, and I decided to strike up a conversation with her. We had a lot in common. We were roughly the same age, both full-time students. I was studying theology and she was a criminal justice major. And in serious relationships with boyfriends we were crazy about. But, of course, there was one obvious difference. She was pregnant and I was not. I accompanied her first to her ultrasound, then to the waiting area where she changed into a medical gown, and finally to the procedure room. Patients had the option to have twilight anesthesia, a mild sedative, but she had decided against it. She had come to the clinic alone and had to drive herself home. I wondered why her boyfriend wasn't there, but I didn't pry. As the doctor began the procedure, two tears formed at the corners of her eyes, but she did not make a sound. It sounds cliche to say, but it felt like what was happening to her body was happening to mine, too. My face began to flush, my breathing got more shallow, and I broke into a sweat. Much to my embarrassment, one of the nurses had to find me a place to sit down while she fanned me with a file folder so that I wouldn't pass out. It didn't help that she was visibly annoyed while doing this. Eventually, my body calmed down, and after a quick mea culpa to the nurse, I walked over to the recovery room to check on the patient whom I'd befriended. To my astonishment, when I walked in the door, she asked me with concern in her eyes, "Are you okay?" before I could ask her the same thing. Her compassion for me, this brand new volunteer who was clearly green around the ears, was remarkable. At the same time, she shouldn't have had to care for me in that moment. Looking back, I think my reaction was a combination of my lifelong phobia of doctors, my tendency to feel others' pain, and if I'm honest, some discomfort I had with the reality of abortion. The week after my first volunteer shift, I attended a clinic training to learn more about the mechanics of abortion procedures and work through my own feelings about it so that the next time I was with a patient, I was equipped and prepared to center their needs, not my own. I spent most of my weekly shifts holding the hands of patients through their abortions and helping them make their way to the recovery room afterward. It was awkward and holy at the same time, being invited into these vulnerable few minutes of a person's life. One patient, a woman in her mid-30s, had to return to the clinic after her medication abortion had failed to remove all of the fetal tissue from her uterus. As I helped her onto the table and offered her my hand, she locked her eyes on mine and asked me, "Could I look at you until it's over?" I saw that what I had to offer were not the perfect words of comfort or reassurance, but my steadfast presence. It was profoundly simple. In those short, intense minutes, I was fully available to care for her. This is what ministry is, I thought to myself. I encountered so many different kinds of people in the clinic. Teenagers, women in their 40s, mothers, students, Black women, Latinx women, white women, those who were fearful, those who were relieved, first-time patients and returning patients, and all of the clinic staff who cared for them with compassion and without judgment. Meanwhile, I was confronting my own biases. As I came face-to-face with the realities of people's lives that my privilege and access had shielded me from, I remember when one patient asked if she could have a copy of her ultrasound photo because she wanted to add it to her child's baby book. It wasn't my place to ask her why, but there are so many reasons she would have wanted to memorialize this lost pregnancy alongside the milestones of her child. Perhaps she had miscarried an earlier wanted pregnancy. What I didn't understand at the time was that for some people, The experience of abortion is a significant reproductive event that they need to process, grieve, and integrate into the larger story of their lives. Each person I met that summer, and every story I have heard since, calls me toward greater compassion for those who access abortion care, and urges me to confront the systemic injustices that prevent people from truly flourishing and experiencing the lives of abundance that Christ intends for every single person. Bearing witness to these moments and stories has freed me from trying to prove that I am right in the public abortion debate. I am no longer interested in circular conversations regarding the moral absolutes of abortion. What I am fully invested in is working to dismantle abortion stigma within myself, in the church, and in the world, so that we can start showing up fully and lovingly for the people in our communities who have abortions. As abortion storyteller and activist Renee Bracey Sherman says, "Everyone loves someone who had an abortion. We just don't always know it." This book will introduce you to some amazing people willing to share their abortion stories. I ask that you receive them with open hearts and abundant love. About the process. Abortion is never abstract. Every single one happens within a person's real, full, and complex life. When the inspiration for this project came to me, I knew that my ability to write it hinged on the willingness and generosity of others, many of them strangers, to share their abortion experiences with me. To put it plainly, without their stories, this book would not exist. For them to trust me to listen and capture their experiences accurately and holistically was an act of faith and a precious gift that I did not accept lightly. I owe a debt of gratitude to each and every one of them for their open hearts, their authenticity, and their graciousness with me. I pray that I have done their stories justice. At the beginning of the process, I had to determine the best way to invite people into the project. Some suggested an open call on social media, but I worried that casting the net that widely would attract people more interested in thwarting my project than supporting it. Instead, I started by testing the waters with friends who had shared their abortion stories with me in the past to see if they might be interested in participating. Every single person I contacted wanted to have their stories included, and some of them helped put me in touch with others who had stories they wanted to tell. As with any project, the word began to spiral outward, and I started to connect with people outside of my immediate circle. I want to express my deep gratitude to Sonia Spoo, Elena Ramsey, Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, Renee Bracey Sherman, Beth Vile, Tatiana Perkins, and Reverend Susan Chorley, for helping to shape my approach to storytelling in ways that center the storytellers, and for connecting me with many of the people included in this book. Over the course of the summer of 2020, I conducted a total of 19 interviews. Given that we were in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, all of the interviews were done via phone or video conference, oftentimes with my then 5-year-old daughter darting into the room every few minutes. To put it mildly, the conditions were not ideal for this kind of intimate conversation. Dropped signals, spotty internet connections, and frozen screens were frequent interruptions. In a perfect world, I would have been able to meet these extraordinary people in person and share a cup of coffee or tea while we talked. On the other hand, connecting virtually was at times helpful. It allowed for more privacy and discretion, which helped some interviewees feel more comfortable disclosing certain details. Before sharing their stories individually, I wanted to highlight the various backgrounds and identities of the storytellers. Their ages range from late teens to mid-60s. They live in nearly every region of the country, some from states with the most restrictive abortion legislation, and others from states with the most access. They identify as white, black, Asian, and Latinx. They are straight and queer, cisgender and transgender, abled and disabled, parents and people without children, partnered and single, living in poverty and living with financial means. They are Christian, Jewish, formerly evangelical, spiritual, and atheist. I began each interview the same way, by introducing the project, explaining why I was doing it, and asking the person about what their healing process surrounding abortion has looked like. From there, I let the conversation expand organically and asked clarifying questions. Some people were ready to share their entire stories, beginning to end, without much prompting from me, almost like they just needed to get it out as quickly as possible. Other conversations were slower in their unfurling. Each person was free to share as much or as little about their experiences as they wanted to. I tried to interject as little as possible, though I'll admit that is not my strongest trait, especially when I feel inspired by what someone has shared. The more I spoke with different people, the more I began to see the threads of connection among their stories. As they shared, I typed as much of their answers as I could in real time, and afterward returned to the recording, which each person consented to fill in any gaps. Several of the people I interviewed contacted me after our conversation to share things that they had forgotten. Some sent me blog posts, articles, and poetry that they had written about their abortions, which I tried to incorporate into my retelling of their stories whenever possible. After completing all of the interviews, I crafted a first draft of each story, printed them off, and began to meditate on them. Truly, the stories showed me the way forward. At first, organizing them under common themes was an overwhelming process because so many patterns and similarities showed up in story after story. After some shuffling, I began to weave sets of narratives together in my mind and settled on a single frame for each grouping. Then I began to do my research of how these particular stories pointed to underlying systemic issues, oftentimes matters of social inequity, but also concepts of how we collectively make sense of things that happen in our lives. My research assistant, Rose Miller, was a tremendous help to me during this portion of the process. She dutifully looked up journal articles, read books, and took copious notes, quickly shifting gears as I refined my project time and time again. Once I had a first draft of their stories, I contacted each of the interviewees to provide feedback, critique, and corrections. Two of them decided in the end not to have their stories included. Each of the 17 storytellers whose stories appear in the book have given their approval. Looking back, 19 interviews is both a lot and not much at all. The accounts in this book in no way represent every single kind of abortion story. I know some particular experiences are missing. The experiences of indigenous people, undocumented immigrants, trans men, and those who had abortions in the third trimester. I recognize that this is in part because of my own distance from these communities and the additional stigma and barriers that people in these groups experience in telling their abortion stories. Recognizing the very real limits of this project, I do hope that the stories included will shift the ways that we approach conversations about abortion, both privately and publicly, and especially in Christian circles. I hope that I can leverage my privilege as a white, straight woman and an ordained Baptist minister to amplify the experiences of those most impacted by the culture of shame and stigma surrounding abortion, and that their wisdom would shape our responses to abortion moving forward. A note on language. Access to abortion is a matter of human rights that impacts all of us, regardless of our gender identity. Throughout the book, I use gender-inclusive terms like pregnant people and people who can become pregnant. This is to ensure that the language is inclusive of people who have abortions who do not identify as cisgender women, including trans men and non-binary individuals, as well as to acknowledge that not all cisgender women are capable of becoming pregnant. Recognizing that language is ever-evolving, in our pursuit of reproductive freedom and dignity for all people, let us commit to using the terms, language, and frames that hold space for all of us. Part 1. Introduction. Chapter 1. Honoring Your Experience of Abortion. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. Mark, chapter 5, verse 33. One of my favorite Bible stories is in the Gospel of Mark. A woman has been suffering from hemorrhaging for 12 years. Her constant bleeding destroys her strength and presumably her fertility. In her search for a cure, she spends all...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?